From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Dave Alvin pays tribute to songwriters from his home state. His new CD, West of the West, features songs by Tom Waits, Brian Wilson, Jerry Garcia, Merle Haggard, and others who were born or raised in California. Alvin has recorded roots rock with the Blasters, punk with the band X, and country with the Knitters, and has recorded several solo albums. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews two historical novels, and classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews some vintage film musicals just released on DVD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What do Brian Wilson, Merle Haggard, Tom Waits, and John Fogerty have in common? They were born and raised in California, and they're among the California songwriters that Dave Alvin pays tribute to on his new CD, West of the West. Alvin is a songwriter, singer, and guitarist who was born, raised, and still lives in California. In the 80s, he and his brother Phil played in their roots rock band, The Blasters. He left the band in 86 and for a short time played lead guitar for the L.A. punk band X. Alvin still plays with the founders of X, John Doe and Exene Cervenka, in the country band The Knitters. He's also recorded several albums of his own songs and tours often with his band The Guilty Men. In 2000, Dave Alvin won a Grammy with his traditional folk album Public Domain. Let's start with a song from West of the West that I'm sure you'll recognize, a Beach Boys hit written by Brian Wilson.
I have watched you on the shore, standing by the ocean's roar. Do you love me? Do you serve for a girl?
Serve a girl, serve a girl.
We could ride the surf. While our love would grow, and in my woody, I would take you everywhere I go. So I say,
that's Dave Alvin from his new CD, West of the West. Dave Alvin, welcome back to Fresh Air. Why did you want to include Surfer Girl on your CD of songs by California composers?
One is that Brian Wilson is you know, considered the ultimate California songwriter. But the other reason was I wanted to do something that combined, you know, sort of the surf music scene and the L.A. R&B scene. And because I know that for all of his four freshmen influence, Hilo's influence on Brian Wilson, that they also grew up, Beach Boys also grew up hearing the local R&B stuff like Jesse Belvin and Richard Berry and people like that. So I thought Hawthorne is about 2-3 miles from where the Calvanes come from. And the Calvanes are a real R&B vocal quartet doo-wop group that started making records out here in the early 50s. And so I thought, you know, let's bridge that 2-3 mile distance, and that was really one of the reasons. I had a couple of personal reasons I wanted to do it too, but
we'll get to goes in a second.
Yeah,
you know, it's
so. I mean, there was a funny bit, you know, at least funny to me, and a telling story about Los Angeles, California, and in a way the entire American culture. And a conversation I had with Fred Willis, who's the leader of the Calvanes. And I had sent him like a Beach Boys Greatest Hits CD to make a vocal arrangement of the song. And then I called him and I said, well, what do you think? And he goes, oh, well, that guy's a genius, man. He's, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then he played me his arrangement and it sounded gorgeous. And he says, I just have one question. Well, what's that? And he goes, what's a Woody? And to me, that was really telling because, like I said, Hawthorne, where Brian Wilson was from, where the Beach Boys were from, and southern central L.A., where the Calvanes are from, it's 2-3 miles, and it's a whole different language, it's a different culture, and that's one of the stereotypes, or one of the anti-stereotypes of California is people don't understand the mix of cultures here and the differences in just 2-3 miles, you know.
And for anybody wondering, so what is a Woody? It's like one of those station wagons with wood
with
paneling.
Wood on the side.
Right,
yeah, exactly. And so I told Fred, I said, yeah, well, you know, the surfers used to have those station wagons with the wood Oh, they called those Woodies? And I was like, yeah. So there you go. Yeah.
You know, it's so interesting to hear you singing a Brian Wilson song because your voices are like couldn't be more opposite. He has that like falsetto and your voice is really deep. And when you sing Surfer Girl, it almost sounds like what you're longing for isn't necessarily the Surfer Girl. It's like another time. It's youth. It's Do you know what I mean? It's like.
Yeah, yeah. There's the bittersweet quality, you know. But it's kind of like some songs, because Surfer Girl was such a huge hit, and it became sort of an icon, right? That when you hear Surfer Girl, most people just hear it, you know. They don't think about it. They don't do any. It's just, do you love me? Do you, Surfer Girl? You know. In all of Brian Wilson's music, there's an underlying drone of melancholy.
Mm-hmm.
No matter if it's, you know, California Girls or Good Vibrations, underneath it is this, you know, and maybe sometimes in the chord structure of the songs, things like that, you can just sense the melancholy. And so I kind of wanted it to be bittersweet, a little bit melancholy. And yeah, it's kind of, as you said, it's kind of referring back to the California mythology in a sweet way, but it's also, maybe that doesn't exist, maybe it never existed.
Do you have personal connections to the song?
To the song, no, but to the concept, yes. Of Surfer Girl, yeah, I do.
To the concept? To the concept of yearning for Surfer Girls? Is that what you mean?
Uh-huh. Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah. It's a love, for me, it's a love song, let's put it that way.
Why did you want to do an album of songs by California songwriters?
It's something that came into my brain about 15 years ago. Tom Russell, the great songwriter, and I were putting together a tribute record to Merle Haggard. And we were just talking about, you know, Merle as a California songwriter because he is. And then, you know, the idea started forming in my mind. You know, it would be cool to do as a whole album of the native California songwriters, not the transplants, but the people that grew up here. And then, you know, over the years, I'd put it on the back burner or whatever. And my previous album was a collection of all original songs called Ashgrove, and it was sort of for my dad. And this is the record for my mom. My dad came out to California from Indiana. He literally rode the rails out in the 1930s. And that's got its whole mystique and mythology and all that. My mom's family goes back to the 1870s out here, and we were brought up in a way with my mother's family to think of ourselves as Californian, you know, and to think of ourselves as distinct from the rest of the country in a way, you know, because we're separated by deserts and mountains, and everything was back east. That was the phrase. You know, if you talked about Wisconsin, Virginia, New York, Phoenix, you know, that's back east, you know. And back east kind of implied, well, that's back there. That's in our past. This is our future.
Your father was a union organizer in California mining camps. Did you grow up with union songs, protest songs, or mining songs?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We'd sit around the kitchen table, and my dad had the little... Even though my dad was not a wobbly, he had the little red wobbly songbook, and we'd pull it out. He'd pull it out. Actually, we'd pull it out. He didn't have to. He knew them all by heart. So, yeah, there were times when he'd maybe had a little too much vodka, and, you know, Solidarity Forever and We Shall Overcome, the Union version, and Joe Hill, and all the songs would come out. And, yeah, so that was definitely a part of my shaping my view of the world. He was an organizer for both steelworkers out here in cities like Maywood and Fontana that used to have, you know, steel mills and, you know, cities on the east side of L.A., but also in the greater west, the southwest, yeah, it was coal and copper miners in Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, Wyoming, Colorado. And in the summers growing up, we would spend our, you know, he'd pull us out of school, or we would spend the summers living in motel rooms on organizing trips. And and though a lot of those images, when you see them at 5, 6, 7 years old, of company towns down in the Rocky Mountains, and clandestine union rallies at midnight in small little, like I said, company towns, and that sticks with you.
My guest is Dave Alvin. His new CD is called West of the West. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is singer, songwriter, and guitarist Dave Alvin. His new CD, West of the West, pays tribute to songwriters from his home state, California. One of the people who you include on this new CD is Merle Haggard, who, I guess, was he born in Bakersfield, California?
He was technically born in Oildale, which is on the north side of the Kern River, and it was sort of the economic dividing line between the haves and the have-nots, and Oildale being the have-nots at the time. You know, it was where the Dust Bowl diaspora was one of the places, you know, that they could live. Back in the Dust Bowl days, there were restrictive covenants out here in some places where people from Oklahoma and Arkansas could live, and Oildale was one of those kind of places. And yeah, he was born in Oildale.
So he's known as one of the creators of, you know, what's called the Bakersfield sound. What is that sound? What does it mean to you?
To me, it's well, you know, I interviewed Buck Owens a few years ago, and I asked him, what's the difference between West Coast country and back East country? And he said, buckle polishing. And I was like, yeah. And he goes, yeah, you know, back East, you had to hold your partner at a, you know, an acceptable distance of like a foot away from you. And he said, but out here, the morals were looser and you could shine each other's buckles. You could grab your partner and hold her real close. And so that kind of, in a way, explains it in that there could be a lot more influences in the music, in country music, than maybe there were back East. If you listen to, you know, there's more R&B. The guitars are aggressive, whether it's the pedal steel or the Telecaster guitars of, you know, Roy Nichols and Ralph Mooney and people like that. And if you listen to the records of Wynn Stewart and Buck Owens and Merle Haggard, yeah, you know, in the classic period of that sound, yeah, it's very kind of aggressive, and it's a mix of, you know, there's a little you know, Mexican influence, there's a lot of R&B influence, and it's subtle, you know, but it's there. And I think it's the kind of thing that could only happen out here or in parts of Texas, you know.
The song you've chosen by Merle Haggard is called Kern River. Why did you want to do this one?
To me, it's his best California song, you know, and it's also, I you know, maybe to me it's his best song, period. And it covers a lot of ground in that it refers to the river was a boundary, and that was a big boundary back then, you know, in the 40s and 50s between what I was saying between the economic have-nots in Oildale and the economic haves on the south side of the Kern River in Bakersfield proper. And I think that artists are shaped by everything, including their environment. And so, you know, with the references not only to the river, but to Mount Whitney and all that, to me, it's just, the song says a lot of things. And it's not just, you know, it's not just like that song from the 50s, you know, Little Jimmy Brown about the guy drowning. You know, remember that one?
The guy drowning in the well.
Exactly. It's not that. It's about other things, you know, and it's about a guy, you know, at least in my reading of it, it's about a guy examining his own life, you know. So that's why I wanted to do it. And the thing about Merle and the thing about a lot of these songwriters is people don't realize they're from California. You know, like I said, when people, you say, if you walk up to a person in the street anywhere in the world, name a California song, who's the California songwriter? Oh, Brian Wilson, you know. And yes, he is. So is Merle Haggard. They're both born and raised in California, and they're both shaped by the environment and the culture and all that. And, you know, so is John Fogerty. Most people don't realize John Fogerty's from the Bay Area. He's not from Louisiana, you know. And when he was writing Born on the Bayou, I read an interview with him once where he was saying he was, you know, that came from, you know, there is a bayou area up between Stockton and Sacramento, and that's where his family would take their vacations when he was a kid. And that's where all the Green River, Born on the Bayou stuff, you know, came from.
Let's hear the Merle Haggard song that you were describing. This is Kern River, and it's from Dave Alvin's new CD of songs by California songwriters, West of the West.
And that river was a boundary where my darling and I used to swim. And then one night in the moonlight, the swift current swept her life away.
Now I live on Lake Shasta, and Lake Shasta is where I will stay. And I'll never swim Kern River again. It was there that I met her, there that I lost my best friend. Now I live in the mountains, I drifted up here with the wind. And I may drown in still waters, I'll never swim Kern River again.
That's the Merle Haggard song, Kern River, from Dave Alvin's new CD of recordings by California songwriters. The CD is called West of the West. One of the interesting things about your new CD is that you've chosen songs that show a different side of some songwriters that we know. And as an example, I'll use Richard Berry, who, you know, is, his song is more famous than he is. You know, he wrote Louie Louie and had the first recording of it. But everybody knows Louie Louie. Not everybody knows Richard Berry, and most people certainly don't know the song of his that you've decided to do on the new CD. So talk a little bit about what he means to you as a songwriter, and what about the song that you chose?
Oh, Richard Berry, it just always been one of my favorites. He was a great singer, and he was a seminal guy in the L.A. R&B scene. And I was sort of torn between choosing Richard Berry or choosing Jesse Belvin, who is sort of the genius of the 50s L.A. R&B. There's no way on earth I could sing like Jesse Belvin. And there's really no way I can sing like Richard Berry, but I could kind of get myself around the song I'm Bewildered, which was a song I bought when I was a junior record collector when I was 11 years old. I bought it at a swap meet in Paramount, a scratchy copy, Paramount, California, for like a quarter. And I just always dug the song. And it was also a way of me of giving a little nod to one of the other, one of my other L.A. R&B blues heroes, which was Johnny Guitar Watson. And I always considered Watson and Richard Berry kind of, partners, even though they never recorded together. So I just decided I'll do I'm Bewildered as if Johnny Guitar Watson's doing the guitar lead. That was my tribute to L.A. R&B. And also, Richard Berry, when he passed away a few years ago, and when Johnny Guitar Watson passed away a few years ago, a lot of what I love about L.A. was gone with them. They were the seminal guys. They were always on the scene. When I was growing up as a kid, you'd always see their names in the front of clubs and all that. Richard Berry, Johnny Guitar Watson at the Tudor Room, on Florence Avenue or something. And I would just be, wow, I want to go live in that world. I want to go live in the world of Richard Berry and Johnny Guitar Watson, So this was my tribute to that.
Okay, so this is a song by Richard Berry called I'm Bewildered, and it's sung by Dave Alvin, featured on his new CD of songs by California songwriters called West of the West.
I'm bewildered, lost in a dream of you. Oh, but what can I do? My whole life is through if I can't have you. My friends all tell me what a great big fool I've been, but what difference does it make how much this fool can take if I can't have you? Oh, it seems as though I've been lost in a world never known. Darling, show me the way through the dark by being mine alone. Oh, please believe me.
Dave Alvin singing a song by Richard Berry from his new CD, West of the West. Did you know Richard Berry?
No, I kind of met him once. Again, I'd been collecting his old records since I was a kid. And you know, he was a guy that had done a lot of things. He was in bands like the Flares. He did the great duet with Etta James on her answer to Work With Me Annie on Dance With Me Henry, you know. All right, baby, you know. And just a big, you know, L.A. R&B guy. And we did a benefit in, I think it was the early 90s, late 80s. And he had just finally got the money after his publishing for Louie Louie. So he had just become a rich man. And we did this benefit, and we're backstage in a dressing room. And I am very shy, and I never realized how shy I was because I could not say one word to him. Like, I could not say, I've been collecting your records since I was 12 years old, Mr. Berry, and I just think it's a great honor to be. And he was the sweetest guy in the world, and he was actually friends with a friend of mine, and I was just too intimidated to say one word. I held him in such high regard, and still do.
Dave Alvin will be back in the second half of the show. Here's another track from his new CD, West of the West, paying tribute to California songwriters. This is a Grateful Dead song written by Jerry Garcia and Robert Hunter. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
If I had a gun for every ace I've drawn, you know I could.
Support for NPR comes from Capella University, an accredited university online with degrees in business, IT, education, human services, and psychology. Capella.edu. From the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Lord Schwartz reviews a few movie musicals that have just come out on DVD. Book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews two historical novels. And Dave Alvin tells us about writing his song, 4th of July. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with singer, songwriter, and guitarist Dave Alvin. His new CD, West of the West, pays tribute to songwriters from his home state, California. In addition to his solo work, Alvin co-founded the roots rock band, The Blasters, was the lead guitarist with the punk band X, and plays with the country band, The Knitters. One thing I should bring up that has absolutely nothing to do with your new CD is that you've done the voice for a Jim Beam commercial.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, like, how you got to be their voice. Where did they think, oh, there's a voice that sounds like it's done a lot of drinking?
Yeah, it may be. I don't want to. I don't know. I just got called. They said, you know, you want to go down and try out and do a Jim Beam thing? And I was like, yeah, sure, I'll go down and do it. You know, I got bills to pay. And, I guess they figured that, I never really thought of it. Yeah, but I guess I sound like a guy that's drank a little bit, I guess.
And it's just a voiceover. You don't sing on it, right?
No. I'm just reading. You know, people have called me in before to do voiceovers, and I fail miserably because I lack the sales gene. And I can read whatever they give me, you know, and I can, you know, put it on. The worst one was cornflakes. I get a phone call from some ad company, and they said, "Oh, the copywriter is, you know, he's a big fan, loves your voice, and he really wants you to do this ad." And at the time, I really needed some money, you know. I was like, "Sure." So I go down to the voiceover studio, and it's an ad for cornflakes, and it was one of these things where it was like, "It's 8:15. Your husband's left for work. The kids are at school. Now it's your time. Your time to be alone with your cup of espresso and a bowl of cornflakes." You know, I couldn't do it. And the poor woman engineer was just, she was like, "Look, you've got this gig. You're going to get a lot of money. You know, you get some checks. It's going to be great. You just got to say cornflakes right." And there's a skill to saying cornflakes that, guess what, I don't have. You know, she just says, "Okay, I'll tell you what, I'm just going to run the tape machine. Just say cornflakes 50 times, and I'll find one in there." And so I don't have the selling gene, but the Jim Beam ad didn't require me selling. I was just talking, so I can do that, you know.
So that was supposed to be like the mellow, the mellow Dave Alvin.
Yeah, exactly, the mellow. Yeah, sort of like I'm the guy coming in the back door after the husband left. "Hello, honey, you've got your," you know what I mean? It's kind of, you know, I guess.
I don't think that's what they had in mind.
Oh, really?
Maybe they do, huh? Oh, I did it.
I don't know. I just, all I know is I read it kind of like, yeah, kind of like Barry White, I guess, you know. "How are those cornflakes?" You know,
my
that
dear.
Would have got me the ad right there. Yeah, but I just remember it for like literally 5 minutes of me just going, "Cornflakes, cornflakes, 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 cornflakes." And I'm not an actor. I have absolutely no acting, you know, experience, acting training, and I never sold anything. I was not a salesman, and so I don't have that skill, you know.
You know, while I got you here, I thought we could listen to something from the latest Knitters album, which came out about a year ago or something.
Yeah, a little over. Yeah.
And since we never had a chance to talk about that, why don't you compare a little bit? You know, you're in the Knitters with John Doe and Exene Cervenka, who, you know, were also X. You were all in X together. So the bands are so similar and so different. You know, you do some of the same songs, but X had more kind of, you know, hard-edged punk kind of sound, and the Knitters are more, you know, like rootsy, in some cases almost bluegrass sound, or country sound. So can you talk about playing both ends of that music with the same people, what that's like? And
Well, the Knitters was an escape valve, you know. When we put it together back in like 1982, it was an escape valve to get me, you know, some break from the Blasters, and it was a chance for John and Exene and DJ to get a break from being, you know, these sort of, you know, hardcore punk rockers. And it was a goof, you know what I mean? It was like, well, let's do a Lead Belly song, let's do a Merle Haggard song, let's do a Carter Family song, and hey, we're a little out of tune. Oh, big deal, you know, it's the Knitters, you know. And and you don't want to think too much about it. And the record, you know, the record we did last year was the first record we did in 20-some years. And it was like, yeah, we'll do another one in 20 years, maybe. You know, I don't know.
Well, in the spirit of it's just fun, there's a really fun version of Born to Be Wild on this. That's, much more, I don't know, country or bluegrass version of it. Whose idea was it to do it this way?
I think it was John's. And, you know, the idea he had was, songs like Louie Louie and Free Bird, you know, they're passing into the folk canon now, you know, because people sit around at home and that's what they play, you know. And you go to some parts of the country and, yeah, people, there'll be kids that are, you know, still learning how to play, you know, old Joe Clark or something, and then they'll turn around and play Stairway to Heaven. So kind of was like, okay, what would the Knitters characters be doing now? And the idea was kind of like, well, we just learned this hip rock song called Born to Be Wild, you know?
Okay, my guest is Dave Alvin, and this is from the Knitters album. which is called The Modern Sounds of the Knitters.
Well, I like chasing lightning, heavy metal thunder, riding with the wind, and the feeling that I'm under.
I'm gonna make it happen, get the world in a love embrace, buy all the guns at once and shoot them off into space.
Like a tune nature's child,
the Knitters album from last year. My guest is guitarist, singer, and songwriter Dave Alvin. Since it's 4th of July time, I should ask you, you wrote a song called 4th of July.
Yeah.
What inspired the song?
I was working a day job. My girlfriend at the time was working a day job. And there was a 4th of July where I came over. I came to the place where we were staying, and it was a duplex in a kind of a, you know, funky little part of town, and there were things going on in the personal life, and there were kids downstairs shooting fireworks, you know, in the street, and listening to, they had the radio blaring oldies, you know, doo-wop oldies, and they're shooting off fireworks, and I went out and I sat on the porch and or the top of the stairs, lit a cigarette, and just thought, my God, it's the 4th of July, and we're either going to break up or get back together. And some people can see it as when I wrote it, I was thinking of it as an actual, it's a breakup song. It's the 4th of July, I'm free, I'm declaring my independence, goodbye. But as I've gotten older, to me, it's now like, it could be a lot of things. It could be, I think now it's, you know, come on out. Let's go shoot fireworks off with the kids. Let's go dance in the street. Let's go celebrate everything that's good about the country. Let's go, you know, it's that kind of song now.
Has the song ever become like the White Christmas for indie rock band 4th of July gigs?
You'd have to ask some indie rock bands. I don't know. It does eliminate me from ever writing another holiday song. I know that because I'll be busted for that. Alvin's new record contains Memorial Day and Arbor Day and a rousing, you know, tune to Christopher Columbus. You know? So, I guess you're allowed one holiday song. Irving Berlin had White Christmas, and I've got 4th of July.
Well, Dave Alvin, happy July 4th, and thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
She gives me her cheek, oh, but I want her lips. And I don't have the strength to go on the lost side of town in a dark apartment. We gave up trying so long ago. And on the stairs I smoke a cigarette alone. Mexican kids are shooting fireworks below. And hey, baby, it's the 4th of July. Hey, baby, it's the 4th of July. Whatever happened, I apologize. It's the 4th of July.
That's Dave Alvin doing his song 4th of July. His new CD, West of the West, is his tribute to California songwriters. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews two new historical novels. This is Fresh Air. In the summer, lots of readers like to tackle complex works of nonfiction. Book critic Maureen Corrigan tells us why this summer she turned to two ambitious works of historical fiction.
What compels someone, as a deadly threat is drawing closer and closer, to sit down and write a novel? That was Irene Nemirovsky's response to the German occupation of France in 1940. Nemirovsky was a Russian Jewish emigre who had become a celebrated novelist in France while she was still in her 20s. When the Germans invaded, Nemirovsky, her husband, and two small daughters fled Paris to the countryside. There she set to work on an ambitious project, a five-part novel about the current situation in France. It would be constructed like a symphony and called Suite Française. She completed two of the projected five parts before the French police knocked at the door in July of 1942 and arrested her. Nemirovsky was deported to Auschwitz, where she died at age 39. A few months later, her husband was sent there, straight to the gas chamber. Largely through the help of their governess, their two daughters survived the war on the run, with their mother's notebook in their suitcase. 64 years after Nemirovsky's death, the uncompleted novel in that notebook has been published. Nemirovsky's artistic and moral response to the horror that she fatalistically predicted would claim her life. Suite Française is much more than a historical curio, although one thing that is decidedly odd about the two existing sections of this novel is that there's barely a mention of Jews in France. Instead, we get a sweeping vision of Gentile French citizenry, everyone from bank presidents to ordinary clerks, caught first in a panicked exodus on the eve of the Nazi entry into Paris, and then, as Nemirovsky writes, the inert French masses, loathsome in defeat and collaboration. Throughout both sections, Nemirovsky displays enormous energy and intelligence as a writer, as when she describes village merchants palming off junk on their German soldier customers. Women's corsets from the last war, linen decorated with little flags and embroidered Eiffel Towers, they'd buy anything. They inspired in the inhabitants of the occupied countries fear, respect, aversion, and the amusing desire to fleece them, to take advantage of them, to get hold of their money. Why did Nemirovsky choose to begin a novel about the German occupation rather than a piece of nonfiction like The Diary of Anne Frank, to which Suite Française has been compared? One answer is the panoramic quality of this work, the way fiction allows Nemirovsky entrance into even the most mundane thoughts and betrayals of her fellow French citizens. And why write another book, particularly a novel, about the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire of 1911? That was my first, admittedly ungenerous thought when I got an early copy of Catherine Webber's just-published novel, Triangle. Before 9/11, the Triangle Fire was New York City's greatest workplace tragedy, claiming the lives of nearly 150 people, mostly young immigrant girls, who worked at that sweatshop. There have been so many novels, documentaries, poems, and historical works on the subject, including reporter David Vondrele's fabulous 2003 social history, Triangle, The Fire That Changed America. Do we really need a new novel? Well, the answer, to quote Ralph Waldo Emerson, is that beauty is its own excuse for being, and Weber's novel is indeed a thing of beauty. Weber dreams up a character, Esther Gottsfeld, who's 106 years old and the last living survivor of the Triangle Fire. But Weber's novel really gets intriguing when we readers catch on to one more fact about Esther. She's a deliberately unreliable narrator. Altogether, Triangle is a structurally dazzling novel whose formal acrobatics have a purpose beyond their own cleverness. That is, to make readers feel anew the tragedy of the Triangle fire. Listen to this sentence, the last sentence in a paragraph describing Esther's eventual peaceful death in a nursing home. It was more than 90 years since the day she didn't die, but you can only survive a disaster for so long, and 90 years is a very long time. Just when you think a much-documented horror has lost its ability to touch you, novelists like Nemirovsky and Weber make an observation, turn a phrase, and you find yourself startled into awareness once again.
Maureen Corrigan reviewed Triangle by Catherine Weber and Suite Francaise by Irène Nemirovsky. Nemirovsky's daughter, Denise Epstein, is in the U.S. this week on a brief book tour. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a few movie musicals that have just come out on DVD. This is Fresh Air. Movie musicals usually get lumped together as a category, but classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that a batch of original musicals from MGM and 20th Century Fox, just released on DVD, reveals an array of categories that date back to the earliest sound films.
Some of the very earliest movie musicals were modeled on Broadway revues like the Ziegfeld Follies, shows that had no story, just a series of lavish production numbers and comedy sketches with all-star casts. A similar string of loosely connected production numbers occurs in another genre, the composer biography, which usually had little biographical accuracy, but served as an excuse to film big stars singing some great songs. Until The Clouds Roll By, about Jerome Kern, an invented dramatic conflict concerns Kern's inexperienced niece, who gets upset when she's replaced in a show by the great Broadway star of the 1920s, Marilyn Miller, played by Judy Garland. The film begins with a condensed version of Kern's most important musical, Showboat. Here's the droll Virginia O'Brien, perfectly cast for Showboat's best comic song.
Life upon the wicked stage ain't ever what a girl supposes. Stage door johnnies aren't raging over you with gems and roses. When you let a feller hold your hand, which means an extra beer or sandwich, everybody whispers ain't her life a whirl. Though you're warned against a roué ruining your reputation, when you played around the one-night trade around the great big nation, wild old men who give you jewels and sables only live in Aesop's fables. Life upon the wicked stage ain't nothing for a girl.
Though we listen to your moaning.
The formulaic plots are often about show business itself, breaking into it, or putting on a show with songs that had nothing to do with the story. In Summer Stock, the iconic Judy Garland number, Get Happy, was the last to be filmed. Garland famously lost 20 pounds and looked suddenly sexy in jacket, tights, and tilted fedora.
Forget your troubles, come on, get happy. You better chase all your cares away. Shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. Get ready for the judgment day. Forget your troubles, come on, get happy. Chase your cares away. Hallelujah, get happy for the judgment day. The sun is shining, come on, get happy. The Lord is waiting to take your hand. Shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. We're gonna be going to the promised land. We're heading across the river, wash your sins away in the tide. It's quiet and peaceful on the other side. Forget your troubles, get happy, your cares fly away. Shout hallelujah, get happy, get ready for your judgment day. Come on, get happy.
In the 1940s, Franklin Roosevelt's good neighbor policy encouraged wildly colorful Technicolor musicals set in Latin America. 20th Century Fox imported the delicious Brazilian star with the cornucopia on her head and bare midriff, Carmen Miranda, most of whose American movies, like Down Argentine Way and Weekend in Havana, were not set in Brazil.
Ai, 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 é o canto do pregoneiro que com sua harmonia traz alegria em salsa americano. Ai, 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 e o que traz no seu tabuleiro vem de praia, oi, oi, vem de praia, ai, ai, em salsa americano. Ai, e vem de batata, e vem de caruru, e vem de mugonzá, e vem de um boi. Seu tabuleiro tem e tudo que convém, mas só lhe falta, ai, ai, beleguentes, ai, 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 ai.
By the 1950s, a decade after Oklahoma and Carousel changed Broadway's approach to musicals, movie musicals also became more plot-driven. One MGM musical that's often overlooked, though it was co-directed by Stanley Donen and Gene Kelly, is It's Always Fair Weather, which was a kind of sequel to On the Town, the Leonard Bernstein, Betty Comden, and Adolph Green show about three sailors on leave in New York at the beginning of the Second World War. It's Always Fair Weather is a darker satire about three army buddies, Gene Kelly, Dan Daly, and Michael Kidd, who reunite 10 years after the war is over to find that in the post-war culture they no longer have much in common. The songs by André Previn, with lyrics by Comden and Green, further the plot, though they never became independent hits. One high point is I Like Myself, Gene Kelly's self-psychoanalyzing number on roller skates. And Dolores Gray, blonde and leggy, is memorable in a parody of a TV hostess who likes herself all too much.
And now, you dear ladies and gentlemen, guess what I'm going to do. I'm going to sing you a song. It's my latest recording, and I do hope you just love it. But even if you don't, I don't really mind, as long as you love me. I'm watching and waiting.
Joe,
I'm waiting and watching.
Hello, Max. Hello, Bob. Hello, Jasper.
I hope and I yearn.
Hello, Bill. Hello, Phil.
Just for his return. Thanks for the present of the silver blue mink. Thanks for the plane and the ice skating rink. Thanks for the yacht and for the solid gold sink. Thanks a lot, but no thanks. Thanks
for the Scrabble.
It's not that I necessarily prefer musicals with serious plots. I think if I had to choose between Down Argentine Way and It's Always Fair Weather, I'd probably pick the sillier but more entertaining film with Carmen Miranda, the miraculous Nicholas Brothers, and the irrepressibly high-kicking Charlotte Greenwood. Fortunately, we don't have to choose. And besides being enormous fun, these new DVDs also provide a valuable initiation into the history of a major American institution, the Hollywood Musical.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor at the Boston Phoenix.
What a day, what a day, you belong to the Hall of Fame. Baby, you knocked me out.
You're the dame with the fame they whistle at. You're the dame with the brain in the picture hat. You're the doll with a wallop like a baseball bat. A 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, boing! I'm flat.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Henry Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
1, 2, left, right, you win!
You got me hanging on the rope!
Baby, you knocked me out!
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, in stores and online at bn.com. From TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields, online at tiaacref.org/greatergood. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the outgoing presiding bishop of the U.S. Episcopal Church, Frank Griswold. He's tried to hold the church together in spite of the division caused by the ordination of the first openly gay bishop. Griswold's successor is a woman. That's pretty controversial, too. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.